This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. Donald Trump has released his wish list for the U.S. government budget, a preliminary vision for a stripped-down set of services that is far too generous to the U.S. military. The New Yorker described it as, quote, Trump's Voldemort budget, and summarized the cuts as followed. The blueprint calls for a cut of 31% at the Environmental Protection Agency, 29% at the State Department, 21% at the Agriculture Department and Labor Department, 16% at the Commerce Department, 14% at the Energy Department, and 13% at the Department of Transportation and of Housing and Urban Development. The reporter, John Cassidy, concluded many of the budget cuts would be felt directly by the poor and needy. A total of 19 agencies would be entirely eliminated, including the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts and National Endowment for Humanities. My guest is Chuck Collins. He's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he co-edits inequality.org. His new book is called Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. We'd actually had him on our program about that book, which you can find that interview on our website. Welcome back to the show, Chuck.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So first, the vision for this budget, it's a sort of a preliminary, a stripped-down version, not a full-blown budget. Completely doesn't discuss Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, but it just puts out this wish list of the most extreme things, it seems, as though the Republican Party as a whole has ever asked for. And Mick Mulvaney says that he basically took the things that Trump mentioned during his campaign and put them down on paper and put some numbers to them. What are your initial responses? I feel like I spent the whole day yesterday kind of depressed just thinking about this before I had to remind myself this is what he wants. It's not what he's going to get, hopefully.
Yeah, I think that, first of all, I think it's a political document. I mean, someone described it as a long tweet from Donald Trump. So basically setting out his vision or his priorities for this limited government, descaling government thing. People have wanted to shrink government, but this is really a compilation of some of the more extreme ideas that we've heard about. I think the most interesting point politically is just how it hits rural communities and low-income voters. The people who voted for Donald Trump are going to be hammered if any parts of this budget come through. Rural communities depend enormously on public investments, and whether they have internet or not, whether they do have any radio, whether energy reaches their homes, transportation, water, rural sewer infrastructure. I mean, rural communities, as much as we like to think rural communities are independent, are actually quite dependent on federal government. Things like low-income energy assistance in my part of the world, here in New England, is a huge issue for rural New Englanders, and we're going to leave a lot of people out in the cold. So it's a kind of politically interesting how it's really going to backfire, really hit a lot of his base.
It's such an important backstory to this that I think not enough people acknowledge. Forbes, of all outlets, had an article referring specifically to the healthcare bill, but it pointed out that sort of poor white Americans, many of whom voted for Donald Trump, live in a socialist welfare state, quote unquote, more generous, cushioned, and expensive to the public than any in Europe. And it's just so ironic, of course, that many of those voters voted for a man with full knowledge that he wants to cut those services, and he's now cutting those, or wants to cut those services that they rely on. And I just don't understand the disconnect.
It is kind of that juxtaposition between sort of the general grievances about government, big government, Washington, D.C. telling us what we have to do. I mean, this is what Republicans have sort of been laying the groundwork for this kind of budget bill for a long time by basically saying things like, you don't get anything for your tax dollars. It's only really when the cuts come down And I think we're going to see that both in this healthcare. And in, again, if any portions of this budget come to pass, people are going to, you know, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. And that is really going to be the case for rural America. I mean, again, you think about Meals on Wheels, which, you know, has been mentioned, or low-income energy assistance. People take government for granted. I think that's the thing. People don't value, they don't see what they get for their tax dollars. We tend to live in denial of all the ways in which the public sector, whether it's state, but in this case, federal dollars, actually make a big difference in our lives. And it's, I think we're in a way we're doing civics education here, which is, what is it you really do get for your tax dollars? And maybe you don't want to see those things go away.
Right. And we should always remind ourselves, this isn't just the government, some separate entity giving handouts, whatever. We Americans put money into the government through our taxes and should get something back from it. That is expected. That is a normal thing. That shouldn't be something considered out of the ordinary. And in fact, Mick Mulvaney, the budget director in the Trump administration, did acknowledge those things, except he only brought it into play when it came time to acknowledging that you have to ask those people who are putting the taxes in whether they want their money to go into Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Meals on Wheels, after school programs. Somehow that doesn't apply to military spending, which is just really interesting. Right. The parts of the budget that are those programs that are going to be cut, I understand, are just tiny fractions of the entire budget, right? They actually are very, very efficient. They do so much more good than the money we spend on them, right? Unlike the military expenditures.
You know, absolutely. I think another kind of interesting irony is the states that tend to send elect officials who want to shrink government actually tend to be the states that get the most back from their federal tax dollars. So take a state like South Carolina that sends elected officials to Washington to get tough and shrink government. For every dollar the taxpayers of South Carolina send to Washington, D.C., they get $6
wow.
in public vouchers back. That's the most ridiculous example. But in many southern states, in many red states, they send a dollar, they get back $2. Mm. And those tend to be rural states where, again, you know, it wasn't, if not for the federal government, there would be no rural electrification. There would be no rural broadband. If people want access to the internet in small rural areas, that exists because we, the people, have decided it's important that those rural communities be connected, and we're willing to pay our taxes to enable that to happen.
I, for one, am very happy to pay for essential services for people who are low income, middle income, just not high income, because they should be able to pay for those things out of their own pocket. Let's actually watch how Mick Mulvaney on Thursday responded to the press. These are some clips of him during a press conference discussing the so-called America First budget. And he talks first about the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, then about Meals on Wheels, and then after school programs.
I put myself in the shoes of that steel worker in Ohio, the coal miner, the coal mining family in West Virginia, the mother of two in Detroit. And I'm saying, okay, I have to go ask these folks for money, and I have to tell them where I'm going to spend it. Can I really go to those folks, look them in the eye, and say, look, I want to take money from you, and I want to give it to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting? That is a really hard sell. In fact, something we don't think we can defend anymore. We can't do that anymore. We can't spend money on programs just because they sound good. And great, Meals on Wheels sounds great. Again, that's a state decision to fund that particular portion, but to take the federal money and give it to the states and say, look, we want to give you money for programs that don't work. I can't defend that anymore. We cannot defend that anymore. We're $20 trillion in debt. We're going to spend money. We're going to spend a lot of money, but we're not going to spend it on programs that cannot show that they actually deliver the promises that we've made to people. So let's talk about after-school programs generally. They're supposed to be educational programs, right? And that's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to help kids who don't get fed at home get fed so they do better in school. Guess what? There's no demonstrable evidence they're actually doing that. There's no demonstrable evidence they're actually helping results, helping kids do better in school, which is what, when we took your money from you to say, look, we're going to go spend it on an after-school program, the way we justified it was, these programs are going to help these kids do better in school and get better jobs. So and we can't prove that that's happening.
And that is Mick Mulvaney making the case on Thursday at a press conference to the press that some of the programs that the America First budget from the Trump administration slashes are actually worth slashing. Well, first, let's talk about how Mick Mulvaney decided that he wants to humanize taxpayers. He cited the coal miner, the mother of two, essentially Trump's constituents, and says, can I really go to those folks and look them in the eye and tell them that I'm going to take their money and give it to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting? Doesn't cite the military or the Department of Homeland Security, which are the two agencies that see really big bumps, but somehow he feels like he has to answer to expenditures for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Chuck, doesn't that single mother of two likely rely on Sesame Street to help educate her kids?
Yeah, and if she lives in a rural state or in a coal mining state, she's going to doubly depend on the federal government to help undercut that. You know, the public broadcasting affiliates in more affluent communities have more affluent listeners and contributors, but it's exactly in the Kentuckys and the West Virginias where those stations really do depend on public support.
And it's a drop in the bucket of the entire government budget. I mean, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and I should say full disclosure here, I work for Pacifica Radio, which in the past has gotten grants from CPB, and we were working to get those grants back. Now it's not clear if there will be a pot to draw from if the Republicans and Trump have their way. And PBS and NPR's funding, which is where a lot of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting funds go to, they've been in the crosshairs of Republicans for years, right? This isn't just something that Trump can be blamed for. The Republicans should be blamed for this.
I mean, again, take your coal mining family, low-income energy assistance, legal aid. What if those workers have black lung or medical conditions and they need to get benefits? Right. Who do they turn to? They go to their legal aid attorney to help them figure that out.
And they may not be realizing that attorney is being federally funded.
That's right. I mean, community development block grants are actually what sustain community centers and pools and public infrastructure in a lot of rural and low-income communities. So again, it's sort of a great example where in the abstract, we can be outraged about big government, but in the concrete, we're going to start to see just where our tax dollars go. And a lot of people are going to wake up and go, how come my Meals and Wheels isn't showing up this month? And that's because we cut that program.
It's amazing to me, it's infuriating to watch Mick Mulvaney say that Meals on Wheels and after-school programs are programs that don't work. There is no demonstrable evidence that after-school programs work. I mean, we're feeding people. It's demonstrable that they're not starving, right?
Yeah.
No. Where's the demonstrable evidence that pouring money into our military is working?
Yeah, no, I think that's the other interesting part of the story. Is that going to make us more secure? I mean, what really makes us secure? We're going to cut funds for diplomacy?
Right, that's the State Department's budget that's being cut. So on the foreign affairs issue, not just the diplomacy funding, climate change funding, right? That foreign aid from the U.S. that helps countries, poor countries, adapt to climate change. And a lot of the sort of liberal commentators are saying that's going to take away U.S. leverage over those countries and U.S. influence.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think the more we understand the world and world diplomacy, the more addressing the climate crisis and the implications of that globally is a key part of national security. Our interdependence, understanding our interdependence with the rest of the world, and how we're going to have millions of climate refugees from different parts of the world. It's in our interest to help and be a leader in helping people address these problems. And the United States has a moral obligation because we use so much energy, we burn so much of the world's carbon, to be a leader in addressing that. Again, from a global point of view, it's not in our interests to ignore the cries of the hungry, whether they're at home or abroad.
Right. The U.S. has played such an outsized role in creating the crisis that we now contend with. It's not the only responsible actor, of course, but it is one of the oldest actors and has and our per capita production of greenhouse gases is much worse than in other countries. On the issue of climate, the Earth Science budget within NASA has also been slashed. I mean, clearly, as you said, this is a political political document. This is consistent with the climate deniers like Scott Pruitt and other, and Trump himself in the Trump cabinet.
Yeah, and what's interesting is I think within the Trump inner circle, there are people who say, well, let's do some things to help working Americans, low-income Americans, help the base of people who have voted for us. But that they've been sort of, I guess, you know, trampled by the traditional Republican shrink government agenda, deregulate corporations, you know, transfer wealth to the wealthy. So this is really put wealthy Americans first kind of budget. It's not going to happen. I mean, the good news is I think, you know, people are going to wake up to see what's at risk here, and there's going to be a pushback. And in a way, by picking, you know, rural communities and low-income voters as kind of the people who are going to carry the burden of these budget cuts, I think is a huge political mistake underlying this budget.
Now, let's talk about which departments and parts of the government are being boosted. And I mentioned the military spending, and Trump has actually been talking about this for a little while now. 10% bump to the military, unasked for bump, to the tune of $54 billion, even as he claims that, in the past year, criticized the war fighting of the Obama administration. And then an increase to Homeland Security, $3 billion increase, presumably to fund the deportations that result in families being ripped apart, but also I understand part of it to build the infamous wall between the U.S. border, between the U.S. and Mexico, which Trump promised Mexico would pay for, but now basically taxpayers in the U.S. are going to pay for. So can you comment on those two places that are going to see a big bump at the expense of arts funding and social services funding?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is a great example of really undermining the basic principles of security. And we know that, you know, people have said that the wall is not the answer, that the wall is not going to address the underlying concerns, the economic insecurity that many, many people legitimately feel. These are kind of almost symbolic actions. And then, you know, again, we should have been moving the other direction. We should be reducing our military budget and investing that in the things that actually create real security in terms of foreign diplomacy, in terms of international projects to shift from fossil fuel to renewable energy, and investing in the health and well-being of communities in the United States. Those are the directions we should be going in. We're going exactly the opposite direction.
Mulvaney also said that the cuts in this budget to poverty programs is as compassionate as you can get. This is reminding me of how Paul Ryan interpreted the budget office's analysis of the Republican healthcare plan. He saw a completely different reality when he saw that millions of Americans would lose insurance. He was very heartened by that, saying that that's exactly what he was expecting and hoping. We live in Orwellian times, it seems, Chuck, where up is down and black is white. Cutting poverty programs is the most compassionate thing you can do?
It really is this sort of up-down ideology that a very small but powerful segment of conservatives have, which is you reduce government, you actually free people to make their own way and make their own choices. And it's really just disconnected from reality and disconnected from the experience of poverty. So it's just a completely, you know, it's the sort of thing that ideas that people come up with in conservative think tanks where they actually don't know anybody who is in the bottom half of the income group in the United States.
I mean, yeah, when Mulvaney says, let me put myself in the shoes of, and names three kinds of people who he pretty much probably has never been able to relate to, it's quite disingenuous. So now, well, let's talk about the tax plan part of this budget. Republicans love to rail against people paying taxes. Many in their base feel that just paying taxes, they have this libertarian streak where paying taxes is just considered such a criminal thing that it's required of them. However, as part of Trump's tax plan, under the current plan, this was a really good analysis by Yahoo News that said under the current tax plan, a single parent pays a 10% federal tax rate or about $1,255 on a $34,000 annual income after applying the exceptions available. Under Trump's proposed plan, the rate would increase to 12%, and with the reduction of various exceptions, the same single parent earning $34,000 a year would now be paying $2,280 in federal taxes instead of $1,255. Wow, so almost double the taxes under Trump's plan. How are his base going to be happy about this?
It's going to take some explaining, some magical explaining on his part. I wouldn't want to have to be the person to write up those talking points. I mean, this is, you know, take this budget, which does not really line up. There is no tax or revenue plan that lines up with this budget. But assuming that he pushes forward with the budget plan or the tax plan he wants to lower corporate taxes from, you know, the statutory rate of 35, which no corporations actually pay, but he wants to bring it down to 15%, eliminate the estate tax, eliminate the AMT, he benefited from, the alternative minimum tax, and shift the tax obligations onto low and middle income working people. So, if people feel like they have a lot of tax burden now, that shift will come down on them at the same time that they're losing services. And if you think, well, maybe the conservative strategy is to keep people from saying, I hate my taxes because I don't get anything for my tax dollars, and we start to take away the things that actually matter while we increase the tax burden on his base, his low and middle income working base, I don't understand the grand strategy here. It doesn't make sense.
So they would, Trump's budget were to come to pass, poor and ordinary people, working class, middle income people would be paying more taxes, getting fewer services, but we'd have a strong military, overfunded military, and our undocumented friends and neighbors might be dragged off and deported, more so than it happens right now. And that's supposed to make us all happy. What does it mean, Chuck, that Trump has not brought up yet Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security? These are, of course, earned benefits that the Republicans like to refer to as entitlement, even though we pay into these for our benefit. Is there significance to this budget not addressing what is actually the biggest part of the government budget?
Well, I think that first, Sonali, what you're saying is right. The big ticket items, and the big part, the revenue plan, and in terms of the, you know, Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid, you know, not addressed in this. I think it is a recognition that people do depend on that. He did, again, campaign on the fact that he wasn't going to take away people's Social Security, Medicare. So he is, in that sense, delivering on that promise or the, you know, that
as far as we know, I mean, it may change later, but as far as we know for now.
And this is actually where he's a little bit in conflict with his Republican base. Right. They are very interested in entitlement reform. They're very, what they call entitlement reform. They would like to, you know, privatize Social Security and some of the medical benefits. So the fact that he's sort of left that off the table is already, you know, incurring the wrath of some of his right-wing conservative base there. And then the fact that this is so political and just picking on very, very specific things also kind of is a knock. You know, a lot of congressional representatives from rural areas actually know what community development block grants do in their communities and are not going to be so excited about going back to their communities and saying, oh, by the way, that's going to disappear. So you're going to start to see conservative pushback on some of that spending and the pushback to want to do entitlement reform. So it's going to be interesting to watch. And it's not, but the good news is this budget is not, you know, it's not exactly dead on arrival, but it is really in trouble from the get-go.
So let's actually talk about that. What are the odds that the Republicans, who have a majority in both houses of Congress, will pass this as is? There's some news reports saying that the Republicans are not all on board, which is ironic given that many parts of this budget actually are a fantasy, you know, the sort of manifestation of the fantasy that they've been demanding for so many years. Now when it's on paper, they're not on board, which of course, you know, the rest of us are happy about.
I think that they're looking at the experience with the Affordable Care Act and how that's playing out in their districts. And then all of a sudden comes this budget, which if there's good journalism and reporting in their congressional districts, it's going to fairly soon over the next week kind of dawn on people what's really at stake here. And again, there'll be, you know, when you pick on actual things that people depend on, I can just think in northern New England, if you're going to take away the low-income energy assistance program and force people to choose between medication and heat, or, you know, food and heat, that is when that sort of dawns on the constituencies, they're going to have, they thought the town meetings around the Affordable Care Act were exciting. Wait till those town meetings start happening. Wait till members of Congress return to their districts to talk about the budget. The healthcare bill may actually not really move over the next year or two. It may be, you know, very stalled out, but the budget will move. Some form of a budget will move. It always does. And it's gonna be a huge wake up to a lot of Republican constituencies.
Now, Chuck, what are the odds you think that Trump, in putting out the most extreme Republican form of a budget, is strategizing that by doing that, he might get half of what he's asked for and will still walk away getting more than he should get, because that's a strong strategy. It's something the Democrats never do. You never under Obama see these, you know, extremely liberal budgets that they then negotiate down to something more realistic and walk away with about half of it. Democrats tend to start with the so-called practical or realistic expectations. They try to tailor their budgets to Republicans in the hopes that Republicans will be reasonable. They never are. And then they walk away with much less than they should have. I mean, is this the strategy, at least, a sound one from Trump's perspective?
Well, I have to say, unfortunately, I agree with your assessment about the sort of failed political strategy of the lack of putting out an aspirational budget. So I think it is smart to, you know, in a Trump political context, to put forward something disruptive, which is, you know, that's
yeah, this is the Republican aspiration. This is the Republican demands being put on paper. This is Trump's aspiration. We don't see Democrats doing that often enough, even though they claim to stand for working people.
Yeah. So I think, you know, while the whole nightmare is going to happen, we're looking at a situation where you have a president and a Congress controlled by Republicans who have always wanted to, you know, take major access to some of these things, like the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That's just a bugaboo that, partly because the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is a source of accurate reporting in many communities. So we want to get rid of that. So I think we are going to, you know, we're going to see a much more austerity kind of federal budget. And part of that is they're going to be continuing to cut taxes, reduce the revenue, and forcing that, you know, that conflict. Oh, you know, oh, we can't have the debt grow anymore. We can't have the national deficit go any deeper. So we're going to have to, we have no money. There'll be the whole austerity.
There's always money for a new fighter jet, though, right?
Yeah, except for the F-35 fighter jet, there's just going to be austerity. So we're going to hear there's no money, there's no money, there's no money. And what we do know is there's a huge amount of wealth that's been under tax. There's a huge amount of wealth being hidden in offshore tax havens and in exotic real, you know, trusts that the Trump tax plan will further protect. So we're going to create this kind of phony, bogus austerity situation where, many, many people are going to be told, well, we have to tighten our belts and you're going to have to tighten your belt. And that's going to be the terrain in which this is going to be debated.
Let's actually list. I think it's worth listing the 19 agencies that Trump wants to completely eliminate. We're not even talking about reducing funding. Completely eliminate. We mentioned the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Institute of Museum and Library Services, the Corporation for National and Community Services. This includes AmeriCorps, Legal Services Corporation. We talked about the legal aid program, Institute for Peace, Interagency Council on Homelessness, the Appalachian Regional Commission, the Delta Regional Authority, the Northern Border Regional Commission, the Denali Commission, focused on Alaska, the African Development Foundation, the Inter-American Foundation, the U.S. Trade and Development Agency, Overseas Private Investment Corporation, and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and two more, the Chemical Safety Board, a part of the Clean Air Act of 1990, and the Neighborhood Reinvestment Corporation. Those are the 19 agencies that Trump wants to disappear. I mean, Nancy Pelosi called this budget a slap in the face. Are you at all heartened by the reactions of Democrats so far? Could they filibuster this, push so hard, you know, that they might actually be able to stave off some of the worst aspects of these cuts?
Well, I think it's going to be ultimately the social movements, the pressure in the streets that will help, you know, encourage Democrats to stand up and not allow some of this to happen. I mean, and again, this is a lot of those, you know, secretariats and parts of government directly assist low-income people. I mean, the Appalachia Regional Commission was designed to help, you know, this rural poor area in with economic development. The Chemical Safety Board is a huge player in states like Louisiana and states where there's a high amount of chemical and toxic substances in the environment, very concretely helping workers who are dealing with that. But, you know, the National Service Program, that's the Youth Build, which is training young people, young folks to build houses and develop skills. AmeriCorps, the Neighborhood Reinvestment Corporation is one of the most important organizations creating and preserving affordable housing in this country. So we're talking about cutting things, you know, directly that help the most vulnerable and a lot of low-income working people in this country.
You know, it's interesting. You sort of wonder, does Trump really know what he's doing? In an interview that he gave Tucker Carlson, he was asked not specifically about his budget, because the interview was done before the budget was released, but about the Affordable Care Act. And in a similar vein, of course, the repeal of the ACA and Trump's Trump Care, as some people are calling it, would hit his constituency the hardest. Yeah. And when Tucker Carlson actually asked him about that, they said that a Bloomberg analysis shows that the counties that voted for you, middle class and working class counties, would do far less well under this bill. Trump said, oh, I know. He said, I know, it's very preliminary, and then went on to say that, you know, there's going to be Senate negotiation on these things. He just basically said that he knows his version of the healthcare bill will affect his own base the hardest, disproportionately. Yeah. And he's fine with that? I mean, why not send something to the Senate that actually matches his, you know, what he would like to see for his constituency? And I'm wondering if he feels, if asked about his budget, he would have a similar answer. Or maybe he just shot from the hip and he didn't really know. And he didn't want to look ignorant. I mean, who knows with this man?
Another statement like, who knew?
Who knew that healthcare could be so complicated, right? That's what he said.
Low-income communities, who knew? I mean, I actually think he doesn't know. I don't think he knows what a community development block grant does. It's not something he spent his life thinking about. I don't think he has a sense of just how much rural America depends on an engaged federal government to help, you know, the quality of life for people in those communities. So I think he doesn't really know. I think he, you know, his ideological cabinet people put this kind of threw this together as his opening. He's the art of the deal, right? He understands if you want to build a building that's 100 stories tall and you're only permitted to build one that's 50, you ask for a 200-story building and you negotiate from there. You know, he understands the principle of basic principle of negotiation that you articulated as well.
Wow. Well, except he's playing with our country here.
His lives, yeah.
Chuck, absolutely. I want to thank you so much for joining us today and having this discussion about the budget. I appreciate all the work you do.
Thank you, Sonali. Thanks for the conversation.
My guest is Chuck Collins, senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he co-edits inequality.org. And his new book is called Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. You can actually watch that interview, as well as this one, on our website at risingupwithsonali.com. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.